to live righteously.
Hey, it's me, Richie T, and it's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall. It is episode number 136, where in the second and third block, we talk to Russell Stevenson. You know, the Mormon history guy. We talk all about his new book, For the Cause of Righteousness. It's a history of Black Mormonism. So that should be really rad. That's coming up in the second and third block. He always does a great job. Wanted to share a couple emails before we get started. And a couple of other things, too. You can find us on Stitcher. It's The Cultural Hall on Stitcher. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter, at The Cultural Hall. Make sure you check us out on Pinterest. We just passed 5,000 fans on Pinterest. So if Pinterest is your thing, check that out. What else have we do? What else are we doing? Oh, now on Instagram, and that's actually one of the emails. You can find us at The Cultural Hall. We mentioned this when we were down at our Sammy Home evening, and again, a special thanks to everybody who came out to that event. The Sammy's Home evening episode, we did a call out for someone to do our Instagram account, and we got this email from Anna Thorley. Anna Thorley, who said, you know what, I don't know if you've already filled that calling yet, but I'd love to take you up on it. So we'd like to call Anna Thorley to be our Instagram advisor. All in favor? And any opposed? Thank you. So way to go. Congratulations, Anna. I will be in touch with you about how to do it, but you can find us at The Cultural Hall on Instagram. And then this email, this one is from Kevin. You can also hear him at the Sammy Home evening that we did last week. He says, hey, Richie, I want to thank you very much for interviewing me for the show. I enjoyed being on the show. If Robin, one of the other guests that was there at Sammy Home evening, does want to get to know me better, that's fine. Anyhow, I would like to be in your live studio audience this Monday. So if you're ever in Salt Lake and you want to sit in on the Cultural Hall, you're more than welcome to do that. You just need to send me an email and I get back in touch with you. It says, I also wonder if you have looked up the author Jenny James. And Kevin, yes, we have. He says, I think that you will find her story very fascinating. She will be an upcoming episode of The Cultural Hall. We've got some connections with her. He says, I hope to be at another event. I will write to you later. P.S., he says, during the show, Robin and Janae's microphones were down. I'd suggest when you take your show on the road that we have headsets so when you're being interviewed, this way you can make sure all the microphones are up. I would also suggest you all do a sound check after pausing the recording and coming back, just like you do in broadcasting. I will write to you later. So here was the deal, Kevin, as far as that goes. For a short portion, Janae's microphone was not turned on. That was the problem, because someone turned it off. But the rest of the time, it's because people weren't speaking right into the microphone. That's why I'm really loud and why others are not as loud is because, well, you know, people don't speak right into the microphone. So here's a lesson, everyone. Take this down. It's a life lesson. When speaking into a microphone, make sure that you speak into a microphone. Okay, here we go. It's the second and third block. It's our very own Russell Stevenson. It's the Mormons. Russell Stevenson. I did it again. The Mormon history guy on The Cultural Hall.
We invite you to claim your courage by shedding shameful thoughts, actions, and feelings that disrupt your ability to live authentically or feel connected to others by letting go of fear, blame, and your idea of perfection. The Healing Group, where women go for hope, growth, and healing. We're the home of the Sex Girls. Are you a mother feeling lost in a relationship and feeling stuck? Are you feeling overwhelmed by life? Schedule an appointment now. Can't make it to our office? No problem. Meet with a therapist individually or with a group in our virtual clinic right from the comfort of your own home. Visit thehealinggroup.com for more information.
It's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall, and we have him back again. I don't want to say we're dating because I think that people might have a bad response to that.
Yeah, especially in this neck of the woods. So it's a bromance at best.
Yeah, it's a mutual love and respect for the same kind of things. It's Russell Stevenson. It's our Mormon history guy. Thanks for being back here, my friend.
Always good to be with you, Richie, every time.
Really? Literally? Every time?
Literally. I cannot think of a single time where I left a conversation from you feeling like I wished I hadn't. So
Well, I'm flattered then.
Yes.
You just can't stop writing the books. You've got another book coming out.
That I do.
Let's talk about it. Title.
Title is For the Cause of Righteousness, A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism.
So it's a really funny light fiction.
Yeah. Soup, you know, a nice beach read for those of you who are into that kind of thing.
Give me the title again for the...
For the Cause of Righteousness, A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism.
For the Cause of Righteousness. So that's like your big bold and then the... You got your colon,
colon, and then it's, you know, where it's like, okay, this is actually what it is.
We got you with a catchy title. Now let's talk about it. So it's we're going to be talking all about blacks and the Mormonism from the creation of the church in the latter days, right?
That's right, 1830 all the way to 2013.
So that's a lot. And it's one volume, or is there more volumes to come down the road?
It's one volume. I don't know the exact page count yet, but we're probably expecting, you know, somewhere in the 300s.
Okay. So not, I would think with something like that, maybe would be around the 500 mark. So you certainly have.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's one of those things where, you know, you could make it into a two volume series, I would say, but you want it to be accessible. You don't want people to feel like they have to buy this big clunky thing just to get a sense for the topic.
Now, you are also the author, and we've spoken with you here in the Cultural Hall about the story of Elijah Abels, and the title of that book is...
It's Black Mormon, the Story of Elijah
Black
Abels.
Black Mormon.
There you go.
Big right. title, Black Mormon, colon, the story of Elijah Abels. Who was, and I imagine, will be a good portion of this new book.
You know, that... he does certainly get a fair treatment in it, but that being said, I want people to understand there is far more to Black Mormon history than just Elijah Abels. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would say he gets several pages, but at the end of the day, I spend far more discussing, you know, Black Mormons from Ghana and South Africa than I do Elijah Abels.
I think the best way to talk about all this, and that's what this whole episode will be about, is just let's go chronological.
Yes.
And you've kind of broken it down for us a little bit, so we're going to cover eight sort of subtopics within that. So that would be big title, then we got a colon, and then we got another colon underneath that, and it's these eight subjects. So we'll start here. Number one, Joseph Smith struggles to navigate racial politics. So this is the early time, and we're going to go 1830, 1844. So what's going on in that time?
All right, so, you know, Joseph Smith's childhood experiences with the black population, it was limited at best. There were probably only a couple dozen blacks living, you know, within the Palmyra, Manchester area. So he grew up in a white environment. You know, he was primarily exposed to white religion. There were a few black preachers in neighboring settlements, but his interactions with them would have been limited at best. Local press, you know, they were generally anti-slavery. On occasion, they had certain abolitionist leanings, meaning that they supported the immediate termination of slavery in the United States. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, Joseph Smith was not deeply immersed in interracial discourse. So when he founded the church in 1830, it's not likely that race played a major part of his thinking, at least at least on any kind of conscious level. But what is noteworthy is that, you know, in the early revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants, you know, he does make comments about how it is not right that, you know, one man should be in bondage to another, mm-hmm. That every man might have the opportunity to speak in the name of the Lord. But we really don't see any real indication of his views on race until of Joseph Smith's views on race until several years later, as, you know, the Saints are beginning to enter Missouri.
What are some of those comments and feelings as we do start to hear about Joseph Smith on race?
Right. Well, it's worth noting that when Joseph Smith did make the first comments, he was making them primarily in reaction to circumstances happening in Missouri. So a little bit of background for those who are not terribly familiar with the story. In late 1830, 1831, you know, the Saints begin to conceptualize Missouri as being the promised land. This is where the Garden of Eden is, and this is where Zion will be. But Missouri was a slave state at the time, and the Saints were, in general, in opposition to slavery with some exceptions. So W.W. Phelps, one of Joseph Smith's right-hand man, at least when it comes to running the media, he begins to make comments about how, the Saints would, in moderation, welcome black immigrants into the state and welcome black Mormons. And this, sends local Missourians into something of a rage. Hmm. They begin talking about the Latter-day Saints as though they, supported racial intermarriage. And that's something that no respectable person supported. You know, even if you hated slavery, everyone knew that you just didn't support interracial marriage. So Phelps, recognizing the kind of outrage that this causes and ultimately mob violence, he pulls a 180. And he says, actually, what I meant was, we won't let any black people into our church whatsoever.
Hmm.
So, you know, over the next few years, Joseph Smith, he's finding himself needing to deal with the ghosts of Missouri. You know, being so supportive of the black population had literally led to mob violence in Missouri. So he began saying things like, well, you know, we obviously believe that blacks are descended from Cain and that they suffer from a curse and that they are a dangerous element, especially in large, massive numbers. So we need to be wary of that. We definitely support slavery. It's definitely endorsed by the Bible. So yes, don't ever please associate us with these abolitionist radicals, because that just does not describe us. So that really marks, you know, one of Joseph Smith's first public statements on race. But this is where it gets interesting. Within only a few weeks of his making this comment is when he also authorizes the ordination of a black man, Elijah Abels, to the priesthood.
Within just a couple of weeks.
Within
of
just a few weeks of his making this statement.
You know, it's interesting as I hear you say that, and having studied that history of the church, that portion, that time, probably more than anything else, you don't hear often that Missouri's issue with the church was anything race related.
It's not a topic that certainly comes up in Sunday school lessons.
Yeah.
Right. We typically think of it as, okay, you know, maybe at most it's a, you know, it's a class of cultures. They didn't like that the saints were making claims to the land. But, you know, the race issue was definitely on the short list of, you know, of hot topics.
So do you feel like maybe with this thing with Joseph Smith is that publicly it was okay for the sake of the church and persecution that a statement was made in that respect, and then his true feeling was quite a bit different?
You know, I don't think he was being entirely insincere when he made his 1836 comments about how, you know, we in some ways endorse slavery, or, you know, definitely have some kind of deep-seated fear towards large numbers of blacks. Because, you know, a few years later, he makes comments about how, you know, blacks should not be left to their own to run countries in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So I get the sense from the record that he definitely is not comfortable with large numbers of blacks. That being said, though, he did have a place in his racial theology for individual blacks like Elijah Abels to, you know, sort of climb the ladder of civilization. So, okay, you know, in general, yes, you know, they're a population to be fearful of. But on occasion, you have, you know, men like Elijah Abels, or, you know, there's another black priesthood holder in Massachusetts named Walker Lewis. On occasion, you know, they can prove themselves, and they can live on the same level as whites as far as respectability and competence.
So very much it seems like, though, with the individual progression of black people, that Joseph Smith was kind of on board for that. But as time progresses, Joseph Smith is martyred, it seems like the church, and I know we're going to have to move pretty quick through a lot of this, so I apologize. That's what the book's for, if you really want to get in depth on this. But there starts to be some restriction. So how does that occur? Is it, you know, Joseph Smith is dead, now it's my turn, and I've got some different rules?
You know, that's a popular perception, is that, you know, Joseph Smith dies, Brigham Young comes along, and all of a sudden, in all this, you know, quasi-progressivism falls apart. But the storyline is considerably messier than that.
Okay.
So Joseph Smith dies, and, you know, there's, of course, a succession crisis. You know, Cindy Rigdon, you know, one of Joseph Smith's former counselors, he lays claim to leadership for the church. And in response, Orson Hyde, who is a devout supporter of Brigham Young, of the Quorum of the Twelve, during the succession crisis, he articulates... he articulates comments to the end that those who are kind of neutral, those who haven't quite decided whether, you know, the 12 or Cindy Rigdon, you know, hold the keys to the kingdom, that they are like unto the black population in that the blacks were neutral in the pre-existence. See, this is the very first time this line of reasoning is articulated within the Latter-day Saint community, at least in public. You know, it was probably bantied around, but before this, this is when Orson Hyde, you know, makes it clear that those who do not support Brigham Young or Cindy Rigdon, that they have something in common with the blacks. Now, this doesn't quite translate to the point that blacks are restricted from the priesthood, because even at this point, Brigham Young still supports blacks holding the priesthood. And that's a point that's often overlooked. Mm-hmm. Brigham Young was as progressive as Joseph Smith was during all of Joseph Smith's life. In Brigham Young, he experiences a shift.
But it is, just to go on a side of that, it is interesting to note that as members of the church, we compartmentalize it where it's like Joseph Smith, okay with blacks. Brigham Young, not okay with blacks.
Right. And, you know, the narrative just is not that clean. So, you know, the saints, they leave Nauvoo. They come to winter quarters. And they aren't dealing a lot with racial issues per se, at least not at this point. Meanwhile, though, there is a former slave by the name of William McCary, who joins with the saints in Nauvoo. He had been, you know, raised in Mississippi, and he'd made his way north. He is baptized by none other than Orson Hyde. See, Orson Hyde, he is a fairly complex person as far as, you know, his racial views, because even though he consistently, you know, pushed back against Joseph Smith's, you know, racial progressivism, at least to the extent that we can call it progressivism, at the same time, he seemed willing to experiment. Said, okay, you know, I'm not terribly comfortable with how Joseph Smith is, you know, sees black people. I'm certainly not comfortable with his, you know, views on the ending of slavery. But since Joseph Smith believed these things, I'm willing to maybe baptize a person like William McCary and even ordain him to the priesthood, as he would. William McCary, to make a fairly long story short, you know, he affiliates with the Latter-day Saint community in Cincinnati for a short time. He scandalizes everybody. You know, he creates something of a schismatic sect, and he is known for attracting white women. So he kind of has this, you know, a bunch of fangirls surrounding him, and this is something that is really bad for publicity, right? If you have a black man with all these white women, you know, fawning over him, it just looks really, really scandalous in the eyes of respectable white Americans. He comes to the Winter Quarters community, marries a white Mormon girl by the name of Lucy Stanton. And Lucy Stanton, she was a prominent member of the Latter-day Saint community in that her father was a former state president, and she herself had shown an affection for black preachers back during the Kirtland era. And immediately this marriage, you know, sends a shockwave throughout the Latter-day Saint community in Winter Quarters. They began to hurl racial epithets at them. You know, there goes that old N-word. And Jeez. His white wife, McCary, and his wife Lucy approach Brigham Young as well as other church leaders. Say, hey, listen, what's your take on this?
Can we do something about this? Because this isn't my favorite thing.
Yeah. And they're blaming it on you, Brigham. They're saying that you are authorizing their feelings towards me. And Brigham Young makes a very interesting comment. He said, "We don't care about the color of your skin. All blood comes from the same God. We're all creatures of the same God. And one of our best black elders, one of our best elders is a black man in Massachusetts," referring to Walker Lewis, mentioned earlier. So Brigham Young makes it clear that he said, I don't have a problem with, you know, you're holding the priesthood and having black skin. Brigham Young leaves shortly after this conversation, and McCary does in Winter Quarters, as well as in another Mormon settlement, as he did in Cincinnati. He, you know, attracts something of a white female fan base, and he actually begins to implement a form of polygamy.
Now, is this before Brigham Young? Well, I guess it would have had to have been, because Joseph Smith practicing polygamy, you know, that would have been before that time. So yes.
Polygamy was not in the forefront. I mean, it wasn't publicly discussed, but it was something of an open secret.
Okay.
So it's likely it's likely McCary would have been exposed to it. And my guess is he supposed, well, the other Mormon men are doing it, so why can't I? And based on previous actions, my guess is that's probably one of the things that attracted him to the Mormon community. So Brigham Young's gone. McCary is basically, in the eyes of white Mormon men, he's sleeping around in the white Mormon community. And this basically wins him an expulsion from the community. As one account said, he left on a fast trot to Missouri. but by all accounts, it appears that he left on threat of his life. And I think, you know, based on one man's memoirs, that it was something of a mob action against McCary. I mean, rumors began to spread, and there was considerable anger. There was a real division between those who supported this man and those who opposed him. So he definitely left his mark on the Mormon communities of Iowa at this time.
And take with him his wives?
No, he took with him Lucy, so he, Lucy. His first wife, but he left everyone else behind, and he left them behind ashamed. And what appears happened is, you know, the Latter-day Saints approached church leadership and said, and at this time it was probably P. Pratt, and said, "Listen, brother Pratt, you're letting people like this into our community. What's going on?" Mm-hmm. And this is when you have the very first comments on record associating black skin with a priesthood restriction. It's in April of 1847.
Okay.
And before this time, you do not have any similar connections. You do have talk about black skin being a curse. You have talk about black skin being indicative of, you know, neutrality and primordiality, but you do not have any connection between priesthood worthiness and skin color.
So then what? We continue to move
right. So, you know, moving along, this is basically when, you know, the restriction is beginning to seep in the Mormon into the Mormon consciousness, starting with the Winter Quarters community, moving its way up to Parley P. Pratt as well as Orson Hyde. And Brigham Young comes back to Winter Quarters in December of 1847. They notify Brigham Young of what had been going on. He's outraged because, as much as he supports blacks holding the priesthood at the same time, He draws the line with interracial sexuality. Further, he hears that in Massachusetts, Walker Lewis's son had just given birth to a biracial child with his white wife. And this is when you see Brigham Young really deal with some contradictions in his racial thinking, because in one sentence, he says, "Listen, that's the kind of thing that that should get an interracial couple killed. Right, having kids." Mm-hmm. That crosses a line. On the other hand, he says, "You know what? If a black man and a white woman approach you about getting baptized, can you really tell them no?" But then in the next sentence, he says, "You know, biracial children, that's you know, that means death to all. They are sterile and they are like mules." That's actually where the term mulatto came from.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Is, you know, the idea that when a black man and a white woman or vice versa have a child, that they, you know, there's something inherently broken about them that they cannot produce offspring. That is patently untrue.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of thinking that was somewhat common amongst the scientific community of the mid-19th century.
So these things persist, and Brigham Young very outwardly speaks about this. So then is it the change? Because I know, I feel like at some point it then is just kind of edictly from Brigham Young, where he just says, "You know what, blacks in the priesthood is no more."
People think that it is issued as an edict, but we really have no evidence of, you know, there being an official first presidency statement or an official revelation. And we know that Brigham Young, he knew how to receive revelations. In fact, he did in Winter Quarters. Mm-hmm. But no such document comes out about blacks in the priesthood. So about 14 months following this conversation, which he voices his many conflicted emotions about these developments, he makes the very first comment on record. He makes his very first comment on record, saying that he too, like Parley P. Pratt, believes that blacks should not hold the priesthood, and this is in February of 1849.
Okay, so we're about 1849, 5 years after the prophet Joseph Smith. And so then those men still, Walker Lewis, Elijah Abel, still holders of the priesthood. It's not that then the church went to those people and said, "Hey, priesthood, yoink!" You know, it's not that occurred, but the continuing ordination of other black elders sort of dissipated and no longer existed.
Right. So Elijah Abel, he's living in Cincinnati at this time, so he's fairly well removed from these discussions. In fact, he played an active role in cracking down on dissent in the wake of the succession crisis. He was an institution man. He supported the 12 by all accounts. Walker Lewis, likewise, he was living in Massachusetts as a faithful Latter-day Saint. In fact, for a very brief time, he was the only faithful elder in his entire branch, because the branch was riddled with sexual scandal and promiscuity and all kinds of things.
Is that in the book?
It definitely is.
There it is.
There it is. There it is. So if that's your thing, hey, my book's got something for you.
There you go.
So for, you know, beginning in January and February of 1852, you know, the Saints, they're in Utah. Brigham Young is governor of the territory. That's when you see Brigham Young first publicly say that blacks are not worthy to hold the priesthood by virtue of their skin color. And it's at the same time, incidentally, that he's also supporting the passage of, quote, an act in relation to service, unquote. Now, as far as 21st century Americans are concerned, this is just a very nice way of saying a slave act.
Mm-hmm.
Because now I know some scholars who would disagree with me on this. And, you know, you can have arguments about legal terminology, but Brigham Young did make the comments, I am a firm believer in slavery. And there were slaves in Utah territory, and he supported, you know, white Mormons, you know, legal right to have those slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And the legislature in general, you know, supported this as well. Orson Pratt being a notable exception, thanks to the work of Lee Jean Carruth, who is an expert in Pittman shorthand. Mm-hmm. She discovered a sermon in which Orson Pratt specifically said, we have not received the word of the Lord on this matter. And I don't believe in slavery, and we'll do much better in our missionary work if we don't believe in slavery. But the territorial legislature, by and large, dismisses comments and passed the act.
So it's interesting, too, because I don't think that when I think of the narrative of slavery, I don't think that I think that existed in Utah.
That's not something that's discussed as much as I feel it should be. It would be wrong to think of, you know, Utah territory as being a slave territory in the sense that slavery dominated it, but there were slaves in the territory.
Yeah, but I guess I don't even think that it ever existed here.
Yeah, and that's something that's passed over, and that's not hidden away in some secret document.
I mean, but it's just not of a discussed narrative, so I don't think you ever
go. No, it's been dismissed in our collective memory because, you know, Brigham Young himself noted in 1849, we as a people are generally averse to slavery. But we do have people in our territory who are not so averse to slavery. And to, you know, make matters even more complicated, Brigham Young was trying to kind of play national politics here. Right? On the one hand, you know, most Americans in the East felt that, you know, his, you know, that Mormon support of polygamy was just absolutely horrendous, right? That was just the kind of thing that filled them with, as one commentator said, a holy horror.
Hmm.
But Brigham Young also knew that he had something in common with the Southern states, and that is that the Southern states believed in self-determination. So he said, listen, we can, you know, by acknowledging the existence of slavery in the territory and by not trying to stamp it out, maybe we can throw a bone to the Southern states and they can eventually support our plight for statehood.
I want to talk more about the state of Utah becoming a state and moving into the 20th century. We're talking with Russell Stevens.
And Stevenson.
Stevenson, I'm sorry. I always do that, too. It is Russell Stevenson and the name of the book.
For the Cause of Righteousness.
For the Cause of Righteousness, :
A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism.
I won't let you play that down a little bit. We'll come back in the third block here in just a minute.
Hey, this is Dan, the Laptop Man from PC Laptops. Is your computer running slow? Are you getting random weird pop-ups on your screen? Is your computer really loud or shutting down or freezing up randomly? The question is, when is the last time you opened up your computer? If it's been a long time, it's probably full of dirt and gunk and it's clogging up all your fans and your components and making everything run really slow. At PC Laptops, we can help. Just bring in your laptop or desktop PC, no matter what brand it is, and we'll scan it for virus and spyware and give you a free hardware diagnostic, and we'll clean out all the dirt and the grime out of your computer for free. Yep, 100% free. Please visit us at any one of our 8 locations right now for 100% free hardware and software diagnosis and grime cleaning of your computer. Or call us at 1-877-596-SAVE. Or check us out at PCLaptops.com. That's PCLaptops.com. At PC Laptops, we love you.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Coming back in 3, 2, 1. Hey, look who it is. It's Russell Stevenson, not Stevens. I don't know who that guy is. What a jerk.
Yeah, what a weird, he's a weirdo.
Yeah.
He's a weirdo.
Quite frankly. It's author of the book For the Cause of Righteousness. And I almost want it like in an arching form and then colon.
With trumpets playing in the background.
It's a new book. You can get it coming soon in the bookstores. You'll get it. You'll love it. It's a history of Black Mormonism, and I feel like there are a couple of these out there, but not really, what's the word I'm looking for? Palatable, really? Just like, I feel like there's a lot of scholarly looks at this, and then I look at those scholarly books and go, oh, geez, that's a bit much.
You know, Newell G. Bringhurst, he has probably written the most thorough account of this, at least up to date. And you know, it is an adaptation of his dissertation. I've read it. I quite enjoy the book. I think
but you're just fangirling his work. Oh yeah, right. A little.
I think it's a great work, though. I'm not going to lie.
So people that want to get more information than maybe what your book has, or certainly a different.
We cover the same time period, actually, mm-hmm. and in some ways, I cover a time period that he could not, because his was published in 1981, and I cover everything after Official Declaration Number 2, so that includes reconciliation, an effort to come to grips with our racial past.
Cool. And we'll talk about that here in a little bit.
We will.
Chronologically, though, we're picking up right around the turn of the century. Utah wants to be a state. So my narrative always kind of goes, well, we wanted to be like everybody else, and we wanted a state, so we said, polygamy, no more. And then we said, Black people, oh, yeah, we never wanted like the Black people. What? Those guys?
You know, there's actually, there is some real merit to that narrative, in the sense that around 1879, that's when you see the first time that the first presidency or any kind of organized body takes a specific action prohibiting a Black man from receiving a priesthood ordinance, and that's with none other than Elijah Ables.
Mm-hmm.
So the first presidency, they are in meeting with Elijah. Elijah says, "Listen, I really want to receive my temple endowment."
Mm-hmm.
But
hadn't
faithful.
Up to that point. That's kind of odd.
He hadn't. And according to the records we have, we don't have any contemporary records speaking to this, but he had approached Brigham Young back in the early 1850s after coming to Utah, and Brigham Young had denied him that as well. But shortly after Brigham Young's death, Elijah approaches the first presidency again.
Mm-hmm. All right, now he's dead. I'd like it. Can we try this again?
You know, let's try this one more time. And it's interesting, the records, they don't refer to him as Elijah Ables, they refer to him as a man named Abel, indicating that there's a certain foreignness to him.
Hmm.
So we're already seeing that the process has begun to forget the Black Latter-day Saint heritage.
Yeah, it's Elder Ables.
Yes, it's Elder Ables to you. No, it's a man named Abel, or Ables, depending on the records that you're looking at. So long story short, you know, Elijah, he's denied his temple endowment. Jane Manning James, she was a faithful Latter-day Saint, walked all the way from, the eastern United States to Nauvoo, was a close friend of the Joseph Smith family. She petitioned for her endowment. She's denied. And, she writes several letters saying, please, I've been promised, all these things. And they say, no, you have Black blood in you. So by the turn of the 20th century, even though everyone knew that Elijah Ables had been ordained to be an elder, it was just too easy to forget them, to write them out of the history. Andrew Jensen, he did make a note in his biographical encyclopedia that Elijah Ables was the only Black man to have ever received the priesthood, but that's the only mention he ever gets in the history books, at least up to this time. So we're leaving that behind us, and now Mormons have begun a kind of new white narrative in which, like you say, Mormons are trying to become more like everyone else. It's a story of assimilation, a story of trying to act white, look white. And that's something that even Easterners did not believe the Mormons were up to this time. It was conventional to racialize white Mormons in the West.
Hmm.
Right? They were compared to blacks. They were compared to Turks. They were compared to Chinese. They were compared to any number of races because of their practice of polygamy. So as historian Paul Reeve will be demonstrating for us fairly soon in his forthcoming book, the Mormons were kind of trying to prove their whiteness. Now, we are just as white as you are. And, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, he helped to bolster this when, you know, he pointed to all of the kids that the Mormons were producing out in the mm-hmm. West. He said, see, they're good Anglo-Saxons. They're having all these kids. And, you know, we as a white population, we are facing the threat of race suicide because of our lack of reproduction. So we should actually be upholding the Mormons as great Americans for having as many children as they do.
See?
Exactly. So...
So we work in it. It's also a time, too, of where, you know, the church kind of comes out of debt, as I understand it, around the mm-hmm. turn of the century.
That's right.
And independence and starting to kind of grow more into what we know today, but still and sort of an awkwardness in dealing with the black past.
Yes. Throughout the 1920s, it's fairly common for Mormons to, you know, to celebrate a film called Birth of a Nation. And this is a film that, you know, romanticized the origins of the Ku Klux Klan. And they were,
you know, a real feel good.
Oh, yes, yes. And actually, for contemporary Americans, they did feel like it was a feel good film.
Yeah.
One Mormon commentator says this is the kind of film that causes civilization to ooze up within your breast, right? It was just glorying in all things white and obviously at the expense of the black population.
It's easy as an individual, a Latter-day Saint now in the 21st century, 2014, to look back at this and be like, what?
What were we thinking?
Right? Almost in an angry and almost sort of ashamed sense, a little bit. But I don't think that that's fair because, and I hate to wrap it under this whole umbrella or, you know, sweep it under this rug of times were different, but it very much was a different...
Yes. And, you know, I'm always very reticent to say, well, you know, times were different and, you know, it was what everyone thought. Well, there are very few times where you can say everybody thought that. There's almost always some kind of dissenting voice.
Mm-hmm.
But with Utahns, you know, for me, the best thing that you can do is say, okay, well, why were they saying the kinds of things that they did? Is it based in doctrine? Is it based in a desire to, you know, adapt to American society? And, you know, you can argue definitely that it was, it was an effort to speak and think and talk like, you know, a lot of people were. Say what you want about Birth of a Nation, but it was groundbreaking in terms of its cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a film piece, even though its morals and its ideas are morally atrocious by 21st century standards, you know, as a film piece, it was considered to be groundbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do see that kind of sentiment being expressed, you know, throughout the Mormon community in the 1920s. In the 1930s, you know, there are, you know, issues with, you know, white Mormons' fears of, you know, of black housing black housing units. And they're afraid of, you know, living too close to blacks. And, mm-hmm. you know, you see some activist efforts on the part of local white Mormons to try to prevent that from happening, you know, prevent blacks from living within certain parts of Salt Lake City. You know, during World War II, you know, you see examples of discrimination against blacks, you know, in the military industry and really, you know, throughout the territory, throughout the state. So, unfortunately, you know, the story of the first half of the 20th century is one that is fairly consistent. You know, it's 100 different variations on the same theme. That is, we have essentially forgotten who we were. And we are now adopting quite readily, quite happily, the ethos and the values of establishment white America.
But then we get into the 50s and 60s. It's the equal rights movement. And as we push our way
towards the civil rights movement,
as we push towards the official declaration in 78. So I want to make sure that we get enough time to talk about post 78.
Yes.
So sweep me 50s, 60s, 70s, and then we'll go
sure,
from there.
Sure. So late 40s, early 50s, this is when you... see the first voices of serious dissent against what you might call this, you know, this white Mormon racial consensus. And, you know, sometimes I'm hesitant to give too much credit to, you know, one dissenter or another, because, you know, it's easy to romanticize the dissenter. But I think in this case, he certainly deserves it. It's a sociologist named Laurie Nelson. He had been a prominent figure in the CES community, the church education community. Mm-hmm. He had worked at BYU. He was on close personal terms with several members of the church leadership. And when in the late 1940s, he learned of the fixed nature of this race restriction, he didn't fully realize it before, and I think that's noteworthy. He expressed his concern about it to church leaders personally through correspondence. He had a friend named Heber Meeks who was called upon to go see if Cuba would be a good place to have missionaries. Mm-hmm. And given that in Cuba, you know, a lot of people have African ancestry, the race issue was in fact an issue. And this is something that would end up defining the Latter-day Saints' efforts to expand into the developing world over the next generation. The man called upon to look into this, Heber Meeks, he came back to Laurie Nelson and said, "Listen, Brother Nelson, do you think it's advisable to send missionaries into Cuba?" And Nelson was like, I didn't think that race was an issue. I knew that some leaders had expressed certain racist sentiments, but I didn't think that was part of who we are.
Right. Yeah, wait a second. I thought Jesus said love everyone.
Right, yeah. In my understanding, the race doctrine is not a doctrine. It's just kind of a quirky thing of our past. So when he expressed these concerns to the First Presidency drew a hard line. They said, no, this is a doctrine. And in fact, you're too good of a man, Brother Nelson, to let yourself be swayed by by worldly notions. Nelson, he disseminated this correspondence. He wanted people to know what was being said, and he styled himself to be an activist. He said, I feel it's necessary to expose this to the world. And in fact, he does so in the early 1950s. And, you know, over the course of the next decade or so, you begin to see these rumblings. You know, nothing set yet. It still isn't quite public knowledge. But you do begin to see not only people like Laurie Nelson, but even outsiders say, wait a minute. So Mormons are, for example, they're a tax-exempt institution, and yet they have this doctrine. What gives? And then with the civil rights movement, and that's what really forces the Latter-day Saints to grapple with this in a very public way.
And then we push into the early 70s.
Yeah.
And it seems like we're really late to the game. It seems like civil rights was kind of like, okay, yeah, we're done with civil rights. And then Mormons go, oh, yeah, us too.
You know, it was definitely, it was an awkward dance that the Mormon establishment did with the civil rights movement. What you end up seeing happen is, in 1963, for example, the local chapter of the NAACP
here in Utah,
they said, we are going to we're going to have a protest by Temple Square about the Mormons' failure to support the civil rights movement. Now they were keeping the priesthood issue out of it. And I think that was a tactical decision, saying, okay, you want to have your doctrine, okay, that's your doctrine, but civil rights is another matter entirely. Meanwhile, you've got people like Sterling N. McMurrin. He was a local, you might call him a public intellectual. Mm-hmm. He would later serve as a commissioner of education for the Kennedy administration, and he was an avowed agnostic on several issues of LDS doctrine. He made it clear that he didn't really believe much in the divinity of Jesus Christ, but he said he felt it his duty to defend and love the Mormon Church in which he had been raised. Hmm. So he can stand before the NAACP and say, listen, I think Mormons' failures to support civil rights, it's absolutely atrocious. It's not defensible in any way, but you should also know that it's not native to Mormonism. All this priesthood restriction stuff, he said, it's just because of Missouri, right? It's just because, we were trying to deal with this really awkward dance. We shouldn't have been in Missouri to begin with, to be sure, but nevertheless, you really shouldn't hold it against 21st century Latter-day Saints. And he made it clear, I believe that we as Latter-day Saints are more liberal than we give ourselves credit for. So in some ways, Mormons were, in fact, less than enthusiastic to support the civil rights movement. In that, you know, you don't have the same kinds of lobbying efforts that other, you know, churches are carrying out in the United States. You know, you even have Ezra Taft Benson in 1967 saying, listen, civil rights are okay, and I support them in theory, but the civil rights movement, you know, as sponsored by Martin Luther King Jr., it's just a product of the communist conspiracy. So, you know, unfortunately, Mormons at best had a lukewarm reaction to the civil rights movement. You know, the most that you really end up getting is in 1963, Hubie Brown makes a statement in a general conference saying, we support civil rights. We believe, you know, equal rights for all mankind. But even that was more of the product, at least the product of his thinking, and maybe to some degree the thinking of others, but I would say can be more properly ascribed to him. So it's not a great record. But in the 1970s, that's when you begin to see a shift in tone, as you hinted at.
I think we should probably lead up and tell the Declaration, and then we're going to have to continue this at another time because I don't want to skim over it. I want to make sure that I get you. So let's go up to the point of the Declaration, and then we'll catch up. And you listening won't hear any difference, except that it'll sound different. But let's go to the Declaration. Here's a question that I have. Similar to now, how we have women pushing for the ordination of women, mm-hmm. and men pushing for the ordination of women, were there people who were that faced church discipline being outspoken for blacks to have the priesthood?
Yes, there were. There were a few individuals. One was named John Fitzgerald. Another was named Douglas Wallace.
Are these African American gentlemen?
No, these are all white. Another was named Byron Marchant. And Byron, he was a scout troop leader. He was concerned that blacks could not, you know, have a position of leadership within the scout troop sponsored by the church.
Yeah, he's just like, come on, I need some help. I need an assistant scoutmaster. Let's get this done.
Yes. So he was outraged by it, and he was excommunicated. And the other gentlemen were as well, because in Wallace's case, he actually ordained a black man to the priesthood in spite of directives, obviously not to.
So, and this is sort of an aside, but just curious, given recent things with Kate Kelly and with John DeLynn, were those individuals, when the doctrine changed, reinstated in the church? Do you know?
To my knowledge, they were not. I know in Marchant's case, his activism didn't just end with official it didn't just end with the priesthood restriction. In fact, you know, for the next several years, when he supported the Equal Rights Amendment, which mm-hmm. is what played a role in Sonny Johnson's excommunication, he also tried to run as a kind of a dark horse candidate for the Democratic Party. Mm. So in a number of different ways, Marchant continued the activism. I don't know of what happened with John Fitzgerald. I know that Wallace also continued the agitation. He was an attorney, and he began going after the church for their tax exempt status.
So if you can, we got about I'll give you about 3 minutes, and if we don't catch it when we catch up again, we'll go here. What are the events that really led up to the Declaration?
Several, and I'm going to I'll try to be brief here. Yeah. One important element is increased discourse among the scholarly community. Within Latter-day Saints, you know, you have articles coming out by Armand Moss, by Stephen Taggart, and by Lester Bush. These reached fairly wide readership amongst church leadership, and they were received with varying degrees of enthusiasm. Lester Bush's, of course, having the greatest impact. We have evidence that Kimball, you know, looked at it and he marked it up. But also, you know, you have the growth of the church in West Africa. You have the growth of the church in Brazil. And what you end up seeing is a constellation of forces, both at home and abroad, that required the Latter-day Saints as a body, as well as, you know, among church leaders, to start revisiting the racial paradigms, to start seeing Africa not just as the Dark Continent, but as a potential part of the Latter-day Saint community. You know, everyone knew that the Latter-day Saints in Brazil were pretty faithful. In fact, they were building a temple there. So how could you possibly have a functioning temple without having, you know, a strong body of priesthood holders there? So, you know, in answer to the question of what led to Official Declaration Number 2, which, you know, granted all men the eligibility to hold the priesthood regardless of racial heritage, there were a wide number of things. And to point to one or the other is to oversimplify the issue. So there are a few individuals in the 1970s who were excommunicated for their opposition to the priesthood restriction. You know, a couple of them, for example, one was named Douglas Wallace. He ordained an African-American man to the priesthood without authorization. And as a result, he was excommunicated from the church. Later on, he insisted that it was the Spirit that directed him to carry out this ordination. Another man named John W. Fitzgerald, he was very public and open about his opposition to the priesthood restriction, and he too was excommunicated in his case in 1973, Wallace in 76. So you see that, I mean, there was some opposition to this restriction, and it did end in excommunication.
What happened to the gentleman that Wallace gave the priesthood to?
To my knowledge, he never, in fact, joined the church.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. So Wallace gave him the priesthood as a non-member?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
That's right. At least according to Wallace's account.
Huh. That's kind of an interesting thing. Because I wonder, so if that person was a member of the church, if they would have been like, okay, well, we gave it to you before, and now you can have it.
Right, right. It's a really interesting instance. And really, most of the media attention focused on Wallace himself.
Mm-hmm, rather than the gentleman. Mm-hmm. And those people, they're still alive. None of them have affiliated themselves with the church?
Yeah, none of them have. One has since deceased. You know, they did all know each other. They were friends. But Wallace, for example, he's written a book, a memoir called Under the Mormon Tree, in which he describes his views of, you know, Mormon corporatism and how he feels that the church is preparing to take over the country, and you know, it's kind of this secret political conspiracy.
Cool.
I know, right?
Are we planning to do that? Is that what's going on?
You know,
I want in.
It would make for a much better story if that were true.
So then we lead to the official declaration.
Yes. So, you know, over the course of, you know, really the 1970s, but especially in 1977, 1978, you know, you see President Spencer W. Kimball thinking about the topic in a much more sustained way. Mm-hmm. You know, he assigns Bruce R. McConkie to write up a memo on any potential barriers that the scriptures raise to extending the priesthood to the blacks. And according to the knowledge and evidence that we have now, Elder McConkie said that there were no barriers in the scriptures to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, over the course of the next few months, eventually he gets everybody on board.
Spencer, President Kimball? Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's right. President Kimball gets everybody on board, and this includes people like Marky Peterson, who had been very outspoken in regards to his views on interracial marriage, civil rights, and the like. And
who was he? Was he a member of the 12?
He was a member of the 12. Okay. That's right. So in summer of 1978, you finally have a declaration stating that a revelation had been received that all men could receive priesthood office regardless of their ancestry.
Interesting then, because the way that you explain that makes me think that the declaration came much after, not much after, but there was a separation of time of when the revelation was received to when it was actually given to the church.
I don't think there was a great deal of time. The reason I say that there was a statement saying that there's a revelation, because mm-hmm. The indication that we have is that the words in the declaration did not constitute the revelation itself.
Mm-hmm.
The language of those who were there, they indicate that it was the kind of thing that, you know, it really didn't have words to it. It was more of a feeling, more mm-hmm. of a confirmation, and that the statement was an attempt to, you know, give some voice to that, but it wasn't the revelation itself.
We've had several people that have weighed in just in the wake of the ordained women, et cetera, that have said that some of this was also based on patriarchal blessings given in like the countries of Brazil where these people are, you know, they're led by the spirit, these patriarchs, and saying, yeah, you'll hold the priesthood and yeah, you'll be able to receive your blessings, and going, listen, I just said what the spirit prompted me to say, but this is, you know, kind of in a panicky thing. Did that play into it as well?
Well, you know, ever since Brigham Young, I mean, there was this idea that blacks would someday hold the priesthood. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just a matter of when. You know, would it be, you know, before the second coming? Would it be, you know, after the millennium had commenced? I mean, there were a lot of different ideas about that, and certainly, you know, Brazil played a major role in kind of rewiring church leaders as well as church members' thinking, you know, about what would happen with the black population. Everyone knew that the church was growing in Brazil. There had recently been a temple built in São Paulo. So,
which is crazy to me to think of, that there was a temple built in São Paulo before the priesthood was restored.
Right, and that required church leaders to say, okay, is this really sustainable? I don't think this, we can really keep doing this.
Yeah. And it's an interesting timeline thing, because again, unless you go back and refocus this, and that's what I appreciate about your book and about other historians that are doing this now, is that it's so interesting, the narrative that my mind has created by not researching into it, but then being able to counterpoint it with actual facts going, wait a minute, temple in Brazil built before blacks could, you know, hold the priesthood. Okay. Then they, you know, it obviously is a one, then the other needed to happen.
Right, right. And that was well understood amongst church leaders. James E. Faust, for example, you know, he had formerly been a missionary in Brazil, and he was really putting this in front of church leaders at this time. And, you know, right now he was the president of the International Mission. Mm-hmm. And he said, listen, we're getting a lot of correspondence from people in Brazil saying that they are a faithful member of the Latter-day Saint community. In fact, they're helping to build the temple themselves. Mm-hmm. So we can't ignore this anymore.
So what about, so then the declaration comes.
Yes.
The nature of that event, was it a big press conference, or, because it wasn't during a general conference, it was in June.
Well, it eventually is released during the general conference and church members confirm it. But yes, it was announced in June. And, you know, of course, this made national headlines. I mean, you could really pick out most major newspapers in the country, and even some, you know, moderately sized newspapers, and they carried some coverage of this. And, you know, there were a lot of different reactions. You know, obviously, among some Latter-day Saints, they felt it to be convenient, right? Mm-hmm. It fitting. Okay, well, it's about time. You know, we've been waiting a long time for this. You know, others, you know, they gloried in the greatness of God and said, well, you know, finally, you know, this is in the day of the black population. And, you know, there were some people, I read one account from a woman in Park City where she said, well, I don't really care. So there's a whole gamut of reactions, mm-hmm. you know, in the Latter-day Saint community. So after the official declaration was released, though, I mean, that's sometimes how a time when we consider to be the end of the story, but really it's just a comma in the story. It's not a period, because now you have a period of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. Right, trying to come to grips with Mormonism's racial past, trying to look towards the future. Okay, we've got all this stuff behind us. Are we going to be able to shed it? Are we going to be able to get rid of it and move on? And that ends up being a rather complicated game in and of itself.
So how have we done that? Or are we doing that? Or is it?
Right, well, there were a number of initiatives, you know, within the United States. You know, you see church leaders, you know, try to be more aggressive in their missionary efforts towards African-American community. You know, you have a black branch of sorts being formed in Los Angeles. You know, obviously leaders of the Genesis group were trying to reach out to blacks, and we have missionaries who are, you know, giving presentations in parking lots. And, you know, it's very aggressive. It almost feels a little bit like Saturday's Warrior, if you've seen the film strip scene there. You also have increased missionary efforts in West Africa. You know, you have two senior couples who are called to serve in Ghana and Nigeria, and they try to establish church presence there. Of course, that requires a significant change in culture. Prior to this, there were female leaders of the Mormon church in Ghana, and now missionaries are saying, actually, we can't really have that. You can be a Relief Society president. In fact, we want you to be Relief Society president, but we can't have you running your own church anymore. Mm-hmm. So this is the beginning of the reconciliation process, is trying to convince the black population that Mormonism is for them. And, you know, oftentimes you see church leaders do this through genealogy, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're interested in the movie Roots, for example, right? Well, you know, Alex Haley, he wanted to seek out his roots. Mormons do too. Mm-hmm. So genealogy was one major missionary tool there.
And then in most recent history, I know some of that reconciliation is the release that from LDS.org that the church has done, where it's like, so you might remember a story about Ham and that, you know, blacks were cursed. Well, that's not how we feel. I mean, that is what, December of?
Yeah, December of 2013.
Yeah.
And, you know, they, you know, talk about, you know, publicly owning up to this past. So it's gone all the way back to the 1990s. You know, there's a group of intellectuals in California called the Miller-Eccles Study Group. And it's, mm-hmm. you know, Latter-day Saint scholars and prominent figures who get together and talk about rather difficult issues in Latter-day Saint history. And one thing that they were talking about in the 90s was, can we maybe come up with a way for the church to distance itself from all these old explanations? You know, the idea that blacks were, you know, neutral in the preexistence or less valiant, as it were, or, you know, that they are the descendants of Cain or Ham or what have you. And finally, that came to fruition in 2013, not just with the December 2013 statement, however, mm-hmm. you know, as early as, you know, spring of 2013, you're seeing, you know, additions being made to the Doctrine and Covenants, to, you know, to the heading of it, Official Declaration Number 2, the fact that there even was a heading, mm-hmm. where it says, listen, we really can't pinpoint a place where it was, where church leaders specifically said that blacks couldn't hold the priesthood. There's no revelation anywhere. The church records are spotty. They're not clear on this. And then, of course, the December 2013 statement, it really, you know, opened up the story in ways that it had never been opened up before. You know, you see Elijah Abel, or, you know, Abel's, as I prefer to render it, you know, being named by name as, you know, an early black man who held the priesthood in the church. You know, you see a full discussion of, you know, Brigham Young's comments within the context of racism. And that's noteworthy, because prior to this, the conventional wisdom had been, we don't know why there was a priesthood restriction. Mm-hmm. But with the December 2013 statement, it said, well, there's racism in America, and, oh, look at it, Brigham Young's speech happens to match the same kinds of things that other people were saying. So now you're no longer seeing the church saying, we don't know. Rather, say, well, we kind of do, and it's because Brigham Young was racist.
Geek!
Awkward.
But fascinating that the church has sort of owned up to that. Some people would say, though, too late, or...
It didn't go far enough.
Didn't go far enough,
yeah. I mean, there are several individuals whom I respect who say that they need to come out and say, we are sorry. Mm-hmm. Like, it's our fault, we did this to you, and we are sorry. And, you know, that's obviously a considerable debate, and there are... I've heard voices say, well, you know, in and of itself, the statement goes miles, miles beyond anything we've ever... been at before, mm-hmm. so we need to give it credit for that. But, you know, those who say that we can always do better, we can always improve, I mean, those are serious voices, and we need to take them seriously.
There's another thought of, how can a prophet of God be racist?
Right. And, you know, that is, for many, the million-dollar question, right? And, I mean, that's something that you certainly find Joseph Smith, you know, expressing racist sentiments on more than one occasion. You know, whatever his racial progressivism is, in some ways, you just can't, you know, wipe out those statements from history. And obviously, Brigham Young, John Taylor, and subsequent prophets express similar sentiments. And, you know, my take on this is that not only were church leaders a product of their time, but they were also an expression of what was happening within the Latter-day Saint community more generally. So, yes, you can look at what Brigham Young was saying, and that, you know, obviously is hair-raising, but I would suggest that is the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the whole iceberg. Mm. And, you know, how racism had crept within the Latter-day Saint community as a whole, and how it had tainted the body as a whole. And it complicates the relationship between prophet and people, in my perspective.
Tell people the name of the book again.
The name of the book is For the Cause of Righteousness, A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism.
Available in stores.
Available in stores shortly, hopefully over the next couple months.
Okay. And paperback, hardback? What's going on with this thing?
You know, I don't know the exact editorial decision.
Only online? Is it only
going
to be?
Oh, no, you can get a hard copy. Okay. It's not going to be like Black Mormon where there are, you know, select paperback copies available. This, you will be able to get in bookstores.
Will you sign it if we chase you down and make you sign the book?
Only if you have mobs of screaming girls.
Oh, really?
No, I'm just kidding. Edit that.
No. Only if you have that. No, I'm keeping that in there. Sorry. So we got to get mobs of screaming girls to get you to sign it. That's fine. That's
all
that,
right.
That to me is that's a righteous demand. That's
all right. Very well.
any works in the future? Now that you've kind of.
I'm starting a PhD program at Michigan State University.
I'm sorry, a what?
PhD.
Oh, PhD.
Piled Higher and Deeper program. And it will be in African studies.
Cool.
I'll be working on Nigerian Mormonism.
Oh, wow. Is there something specific or special about Nigerian Mormonism from everywhere else?
Yes, in Nigerian as well as Ghanaian, in that you have the development of congregations well before the 1978 revelation, where they're calling themselves Mormon. In fact, they're practically pleading with church leaders to integrate their congregations into the main body of the church in America. They're saying, we are Mormon. We believe in the Book of Mormon. We believe in Joseph Smith. Please let us into your faith community.
Have you been to Nigeria before?
I'm looking forward to that.
Really? So you've not gone, but you're going to study.
I'll be studying Igbo this coming fall.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know what that is.
That's the language of Eastern Nigeria, Biafra.
Oh, well, of course. How did I not know that? And then you'll be able to go and travel and check
and
it out.
And do oral history work.
Oh, man. I can't wait to hear about all that. So another book forthcoming, obviously.
Yes.
Nerd.
I know. Unabashedly. Unashamedly.
People can check you out online, too, if you go to MormonHistoryGuy.com.
That's right.
You do a podcast semi-regularly-ish.
Yes. We have about 10 podcasts now. For your listening pleasure.
So if you want to check that out, you've also been on past episodes here at the Cultural Hall.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that this has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you're not healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that when the time comes, you'll be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you, Mormon History Guy Russell Stevenson, on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Glad to be there.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat. On the back row, we read.